All right, so this is Jessica Ovalle, and I'm here with Danielle Chim, and we are talking about Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So my initial reaction was that I liked that the book went into so much more depth than the movie, because I had seen the movie first, but the book went into much more depth. And I'm really excited to read the second book, but my opinion of the book definitely changed because the first chapter is so boring. But then I didn't feel that lull the rest of the time. So once you get past that first chapter or two,
You
I
mean
felt
three, the first three
okay, the first three
chapters.
chapters
Okay,
until
good.
Hagrid gets there, then it's better.
I really hate the first three chapters of this book.
Yeah.
But you know what? I really hate the first three chapters of every book I ever read because I hate the world building part of chapters, or of books. I hate the, oh yeah, she's 5'2" with blue eyes. Like, cool, move on. Tell me she has blue eyes in next later. I get really annoyed at, oh yeah, there's like five trees on this particular plot of land. Shut up and just move on with the story. I want to find who's gonna be killing who or whatever.
Yeah, and in this particular story, because it starts off actually from Mr. Dursley's perspective, which is Harry's uncle, and he really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the rest of the story. We need to see how awful he is to Harry, but it starts off with him going to work. Why do
Yeah.
we need to see all that? You know, like
Right.
he they could have expressed that there are magic people and there are muggles and they don't usually cross without taking us to work with Mr. Dursley, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I will give it to the author though. She did do a good job, reflecting back on it. You do know everything about the world in those first three chapters, and the rest of it is smooth sailing. Albeit so boring. But once you get to that fourth chapter, then it's cool. And also I do have to remind myself, this is a children's book, and children do like repetition. They do like being brought into the story. Whereas as an adult, I'm just okay, moving on. Skimming through. You don't have to tell me that the letters aren't coming because his uncle's a jerk. Let's move on, you know?
Yeah, well, and we have the experience of we are readers. We know what fantasy worlds typically are like. We only need to know the abnormalities. Usually this is like this, but in my book, vampires sparkle. You know, that's the only part we need to
Right.
know.
Yeah, vampires drink blood in every single book that's ever been written about vampires.
Right.
But they all have different
Which this book has
abilities.
nothing to do with vampires, by the
I don't know. Here we go, no vampires. Wait, this is Twilight or Harry Potter? But yeah, I guess that's also the thing is when you are an avid reader, sometimes it can get boring when you read the same types of books. Which, remember that one time you told me that I need to start having a better book diet?
Yeah, better reading diet.
Yeah, because I was only reading fantasy books, and then I'm burnt out on fantasy books right now. So that makes sense. You need to have a good overall diet. But I did love this book, though. Not gonna lie, it's a game changer for me. A whole nother level, definitely top three series, because I can't even say top three books, because who could ever say a favorite book like me?
Yeah, I don't know.
So
People who don't read enough,
my
apparently.
favorite series, this is second to my favorite series, obviously Lord of the Rings, shout out to Frodo, holler. But I will say that this is my favorite, one of my favorite series I've ever read.
It is my favorite. I mean, y'all know that. Y'all know. Look around
Yeah.
the
Well,
room. All right. So, what about your favorite part of the book?
okay, so obviously my favorite part of the book is the magic part. I think the way that the author was able to express Harry's awe and excitement, as he entered into Diagon Alley and he got to see unrestricted magic with all of the people that were just like him. And I think for me, I'm not gonna cry, I swear. But I feel like in this moment, when you go your whole life with feeling like you don't belong, and you go your whole life feeling like you feel like your parents would have loved you if they had lived. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you'll never be loved or fit in or welcomed. And you walk into this world. Like, Diagon Alley is like this moment of just being accepted. Mm-hmm. For the first time in his life, like, something's making sense. And it's completely magical. Literally. Like, yeah. Figuratively, but also literally. And I think that that is so important because I think that's my favorite moment because when I was younger, I felt like I didn't belong or I felt like I was different from everyone else. And like Harry was accepted and if he could be accepted, then someone was out there that was going to accept me and all my weirdness, you know, which that's now you're my soulmate. Yeah.
So I went a little bit of a different direction with my favorite moments. My favorite moments actually didn't have anything to do with magic. They had more to do with the relationships between people. So, like, my favorite moment in the book is when Neville stands up to Hermione and, you know, the big three for trying to sneak out at night. So they're trying to sneak out and break the rules, and Neville says, you know, that's not okay. And, you know, he gets petrified, and
that's your kind of favorite sucks. Part of all the parts.
But it's my favorite part because of the payoff. At the end, he gets rewarded by Dumbledore, and Dumbledore sees him and sees his struggle to stand up for his friends. Like, he's that awkward kid that, like, doesn't talk to anybody, and then he says, you know, like, I care about you, and I don't want you to leave. I want you to do what's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite part.
Which is such a mom of you. I'm just throwing that out there because, like, let's be real. Like, that, I don't care that Neville stood up for him. But I get it. Like, as a mom, like, you would hope that you've raised your kid well enough that no matter what, they're going to stand up for what is right. Yo, I'm crying.
Which is ironic because Neville is raised by his grandmother who is, like, psycho, yelling at him all the time kind of a person and not the nurturing person you would expect.
Yeah.
But because he has that similar issue, well, this is getting into further books, but he has that similar issue where his parents had passed away at a really young age.
Just well, like they're Harris. Not dead, though. They're just not cognitively there.
Yeah.
Technically.
True. They have the Cruciatus curse placed on them.
So they're more loopy.
They're not present. We'll just put it that way. Okay, so then we wanted to talk about the author and how she came up with this book. So we did a little bit of research on it and found that J.K. Rowling had thought of the Harry Potter book while she was riding the train one day. And so she basically just started writing little bits and pieces of the book on diner napkins. And then she kind of took a break from it to have a baby. And then once she had her baby, she had planned out the course of all 7 books already and then went back and wrote properly the first book, sent her little manuscript in, was rejected a few times, and then finally someone picked up Harry Potter and then it became like the amazingness that it is today.
I don't think people realize, like, I think this is something, especially for our students, you know, and I was telling them the other day through my Motivation Mondays that I do with my kids is, you know, so many times we want to be great, mm-hmm. but we're not willing to fail mm-hmm. and fail and fail and fail and fail. And especially in English class, because we're both English teachers, like, kids always just write it and turn it in. Mm-hmm. But they never revise, and they never fix it, and they never fix it. And it's so frustrating because it's, mm-hmm. it's like, it doesn't happen naturally the first time. Like, it's important for things to get revised.
Okay, so I think I cut Miss Chim off. She was talking about revision and how it takes a lot of failure to be great, just like J.K. Rowling had to fail a few times and maybe even put her dreams on hold for a minute while she got herself handled, and then she went on to be this great person. Okay, do we want to jump into the book, like the characters and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so I felt like Harry, Ron, and Hermione are the main characters, but sub-characters are Hagrid, Voldemort, and Dumbledore. I feel like all the other characters are just like storyline, world building characters. I didn't feel like there was anyone else that truly stood out as...
I would say Snape, Professor Snape, is a key character in this one. He's kind of like a secondary evil character in this book. Yeah. Kind of.
Okay. I guess I could see that. Like, I guess I've kind of forgotten about him, but yeah. Yeah. He's definitely also probably a person of interest in that one. I feel like the plot of this story is to find out, well, it's suspicious that Snape is so mean to Harry right off the bat. And I think the characters are trying to find, like, justification for his malicious behavior towards Harry. And so when the kids are starting to put, like, the mystery together of what's on the fourth floor, what's it protecting, why is Professor Snape, like, being sus, you know, like...
You're using lingo.
My bad. I'm just cool, you know. But... when they're trying to figure that out, they put him as the person, like, this evil person. And I think they're trying to figure that out.
It's not even him. Like, not to spoil it for y'all, but, I mean, this book is, what, like, 20 years old? So,
so get over it.
Like, but it wasn't even...
Jinx, you owe me a soda.
Okay, okay. So, Snape wasn't even the culprit, and, like, Quirrell was.
Yeah.
And, like, they didn't even suspect him. Poor stuttering Professor Quirrell.
I know. I feel like that was genius, though, because you don't, like, I feel like people with disabilities, there's, like, a catch-22. You don't want to offend them and assume. But then because you intentionally don't assume, they get away with more sometimes.
In books.
Not in real life. You know what? I'm just kidding. Oh, gosh. I'm filtered.
All right. So, starting from the beginning of the book, so we've got Harry lives with his aunt and uncle because his parents have passed away, and they are awful to him. They treat him like a second-class citizen. He lives in the, you know, the room under the stairs. He doesn't even get a proper bedroom, things like that. Even though his cousin, Dudley, has two bedrooms. One that he sleeps in and one for all his broken toys, right?
Broken toys because he's so awful that...
He breaks them
all. He breaks them immediately. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I wish I had a room with a bunch of toys.
Oh.
That would be so much
fun. Is that like normal? Like
growing up. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Your kids have their whole living room of toys. But no, it's not normal. It's called having a toy or two in your bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called working real hard so you can provide for your kids.
All right.
Anyway, so when Harry learns that he's a wizard, basically Hagrid saves him from his aunt and uncle. And then once they get kind of introduced to the castle, which is the school Hogwarts, Draco makes fun of Ron. So Draco is another kind of bad character. Another student, and he makes fun of Ron for being poor. He has a hand-me-down robe and red hair. He must be a Weasley. So Harry stands up for Ron and basically says, like, I'd rather be his friend than yours. You're rude. Like, I'm not gonna stand for it. And so then Ron and Harry become friends, and that's one of the things, one of the themes that is throughout this book, is standing up for yourself, standing up for others. Basically just doing what's right, which I had talked about with Neville as well. And then we meet the character Hermione. So Hermione, my favorite character,
of course,
is the totally book smart girl. She knows all the answers, all those things. She frequently corrects people. Uh-huh. It's Leviosa, not Leviosa. Oh. Which ironically saves them later because they get attacked by a troll.
Okay, you're getting ahead of everything.
No, I'm not.
Okay, go ahead.
They get attacked by a troll in the bathroom.
Right.
Because the boys had made fun of Hermione, so they went to go looking for her when they found out that there was a troll that got loose. And so Leviosa is the spell that ends up saving them and getting the troll out of the bath, not out of the bathroom. They knock him out.
Right.
So then Hermione kind of lets bygones be bygones and becomes
she's the bigger person.
Right.
And she forgives them, even though these two boys do not deserve to be forgiven because they're little boys and they bully little girls. No, and it's annoying. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I'm a little salty about this whole, oh, it's okay to bully girls and they're still going to save you later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't bully girls. Okay? Yeah,
exactly.
Or anybody. Don't bully anybody. So then, are you done with? Okay. So then, after they have saved her, themselves, from the troll, they start getting these creepy vibes, which we mentioned before, from one of the professors, Professor Snape, and they believe that he's hiding something. So the big three kind of, like, start sneaking around, trying to figure out what he's up to, and they find that on the fourth floor, which is restricted, they're not supposed to go there in the school. There's this door that a three-headed dog named Fluffy is guarding something. Okay, so they decide to go into the library and do some research and figure out what that dog might be hiding. And they come across the name Nicholas Flamel, and they find what they believe is in the trapdoor, which is the Sorcerer's Stone, hence the name of the book.
I think what's important as well is when we get the little tiny information that unicorn blood has been spilled.
Yeah.
It's very minor, but I think it's really pertinent to the storyline that there's something evil going on, because who would kill a unicorn?
Right. Unicorns are supposed to be pure and, you know, wonderful. Not even just in the, like, little girl unicorn magical way, but they're supposed to be the most pure thing. Like they make sacred. It a point. Yeah. Like, it's not okay to kill a unicorn.
Right.
So something is drinking the unicorn blood, and they find that out because they got in trouble for being out, which Devil was trying to save them from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah. Don't sneak out.
Don't sneak out. You might have to go into the Forbidden Forest for your detention.
We're so nerdy.
Okay. So then... they decide that they're going to infiltrate the trapdoor.
To save the stone.
To save the stone, because they believe that if they get it before Snape gets it, they can allow Dumbledore to take it away. And he's the headmaster, like the principal, basically, of the school. But he keeps being kind of, like, sketchy. Like, he doesn't want to listen to them. Nobody believes that Snape is up to something. So they decide to just take matters into their own hands. So they finally get into the trapdoor, and they're faced with a bunch of different challenges. And these challenges, the author wrote them in a specific way that plays to each character's strength.
Which is great, but we're not going to spoil it.
Yes, we are. Because I got to talk about the potion part. That's my part that I'm reading.
We're spoiling this whole book for them.
They should have read it. It's like 20 years old.
Okay.
It's like twice their age.
They're 20 years old. My God.
It's been around their entire lifetime plus
seven. I'm sorry that we're ruining this for you. Disclaimer. Okay, go ahead. Ruin it for them.
Okay, so then they go through all these challenges.
Which are amazing challenges. By the way, you should read the book.
Yeah, so one of them is a chess challenge, which plays to Ron's strength. One of them is a logic challenge, which plays to Hermione's strength. She has to solve a riddle. And then one of them is a flying challenge. Harry has to fly to get a key, and he's good on a broom. He becomes the youngest seeker ever, which is a position in Quidditch, which is a game. I have to, like, explain this because they don't know anything.
Right.
So he...
It's like soccer, but on brooms in the air.
Yeah, it's sort really cool. Ish. And if y'all go to UC Irvine, they have a Quidditch team.
Ew.
Yeah. Nerds. I went to UC Irvine. I was not on the Quidditch
you
team.
You were on the Quidditch
I
team.
Was not. I'm not athletic enough for that. I wanted to be, but I was not.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so you're then...
You should have been, like, the cheerleader or whatever.
Yeah. Do they have
the
cheerleaders?
The cauldron girl.
I could have been the scorekeeper or something. Okay. I don't know.
Yes. Jordan. Alrighty.
So then we're talking about why the book is important to the world. Oh, so yes. Go ahead.
I forgot what I said.
About life being complex, too complex to judge people.
Oh, yes.
We took notes, by the way, before we started this.
We did take notes. Luckily, I wrote the word complexity, because that explains everything.
And y'all should also take notes before you try to record this, because it would be really hard if we had not done that.
Yes, and also take better notes than me, because I just wrote the word complexity.
Yeah, but I wrote, life is complex, and then an arrow, Snape.
Okay, so I think for me, this story, it relates to real life, because you really can't judge something or someone based off of one thing. Life is too complex for that. There's so many different facets and avenues of someone's personality and someone's demeanor and their emotions. And I think it's important to that this book actually like emphasizes that throughout the story. And I think that that's really important.
No, sir.
And so for me, that was important to understand that, you know, Harry is misjudged because everyone thinks he's probably spoiled and arrogant because he's the boy who lived. But in reality, he's humble and doesn't take things for granted. And he's very appreciative of the people around him, and their friendship and such.
Yeah. So I had talked about the topic of the father-son relationships in the story, or the parent-child relationships, really. So it was a theme throughout. There's a whole, so many themes throughout. One of them is basically standing up for yourself and others, which I talked about. But the one that I specifically wrote about was Mr. Dursley with Harry versus the way he is with Dudley, which we also talked a little bit about. And then the contrast that that has to Ron's family. So Ron has 8 brothers and sisters?
Sure.
A lot of brothers and sisters. And they're a poor family, even though they're an old family in wizarding history. Like, their family name has been around for a long time. And they are just full of love for each other. Like, Mrs. Weasley takes the time to make sweaters for all the children, including Harry, because she knows that his aunt and uncle aren't going to give him a Christmas gift. So I was just talking about the contrast that is there, and that's one of the thematic topics that I picked up on throughout the novel.
The only thematic one I picked up on was friendship and the coming of age portion of the story. I mean, obviously I hit on the ones that you hit on as well, but since you already spoke on them. But really this idea for me was, even though it's a made up world, the discussing, you know, social economic statuses is also something that, you know, is relatable, where people judge you based off of your clothes or how much money you have. And what I loved about Harry was that, you know, once he found out he was rich with all that money, he didn't gloat. And he was humble with it anyways, you know. So I thought that was pretty cool of her to, you know, do that.
Yeah, to include that in her story.
Yeah.
All right, so speaking of things that J.K. Rowling intentionally did, I wanted to pick a particular passage. This is on page 285. Let me go. 285, okay. So on 285, it gives us this riddle, which I'm not going to read the whole riddle because it's kind of long, but I picked up on that she intentionally rhymed the riddle just to make it a little more interesting. And this is that riddle that I was telling you guys about as one of the challenges to get the stone. So just after it, it says, Hermione let out a great sigh, and Harry, amazed, saw that she was smiling, the very last thing he felt like doing. Brilliant, said Hermione. This isn't magic, it's logic, a puzzle. A lot of the greatest wizards haven't got an ounce of logic. They'd be stuck in here forever. But so will we, won't we? Of course not, said Hermione. Everything we need is here on this paper. 7 bottles, 3 are poison, 2 are wine. 1 will get us safely through the black fire, and 1 will get us back through the purple. But how do we know which one to drink? Give me a minute. Hermione read the paper several times. Then she walked up and down the line of bottles, muttering to herself and pointing at them. At last, she clasped her hands. Got it, she said. The smallest bottle will get us through the black fire towards the stone. Okay, so obviously that passage goes on a little further, but I felt like that particular section just really highlighted the two friends and their different voices. Like, you can just feel on the page how different Hermione is from Harry. How he's just, like, completely dumb, has no idea what's going on. And Hermione is like, I got this, with all her sass and everything. So I felt like that was one thing that the author did. She has her own style, which is really cool, in her voice. But then she also allowed each of her characters to shine through a little bit differently.
Well, and you can see the significant difference. Like, Hermione's persistent. She doesn't give up easily. Mm-hmm. She likes the struggle. Whereas Harry's like, I quit.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to die.
We're just going to die in here.
We're just going to die, you know? And I think that part's funny to me, because even though this is just the first book, like, he does that a lot. But this is also the beautiful part about, like, evolution of a character's personality. The more you hang out with someone, or the more that you're around a person or a group of friends, the more you start to take in their attributes. And towards the end of the series, Harry actually does become more persistent. He is more apt to take in the struggle, whereas in the beginning, he didn't.
Well, and throughout the series, he gets put in these positions where he doesn't have Hermione. Like, in the second book, she gets petrified, and you know, she's not there.
Yeah.
And then in Goblet, she can't help him, you know? So he gets put in these positions where he has to think, what would Hermione do? Yeah. As I frequently do myself.
Oh, my gosh. I cannot stand you. You're so annoying. Okay, so what I chose was the very first two sentences, where it's like, Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. And they were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. I loved that, because I think that shows that she's a little sassy, a little sarcastic.
She definitely does not approve of their pompousness.
Yeah, she's definitely, like, the person that is, like, not okay with, like, how they think they're better than everyone else. Because in reality, this is, like, them thinking they're better.
Yeah.
And their superficiality and everything. And so I think that this is a really great paragraph to show her writing style because of that.
Yeah. All right, cool. So we talked a little bit about our own connections with the story. So you had talked about life being complex and not being able to judge someone based off of one interaction. And I had talked about standing up for what's right, even though it isn't easy, being who you are no matter what. And I think that those are lessons that are timeless, but then also especially topical. Like, with the way social media is going right now, you tend to just follow crowds or...
Well, in cancel culture, it's like one thing that you do defines you as a whole person.
Yeah.
And again, it really doesn't. You know, this cancel culture is really something that we have to be careful with, because just because you make one mistake or you say one thing does not define your entire being or everything that you've done. We're so quick to judge someone off of one thing, and life is too complex. And we make way too many decisions a day to say, hey, your life has been a billion minutes, but we're only going to judge you on 5 of them.
Yeah.
And that's not fair for anyone. And our culture is really big on doing that. And so I think it is important to remember to look at all of the facets of a person before really judging, because you don't know where they're coming from or what they've been through or what they're going through at that moment.
Yeah.
I actually heard a quote today that said, don't be the scissors that cut someone's string. Mm. And I totally butchered that, I'm sure. But the point is, like, if someone is at their breaking point and they're being held by just a string, don't be the scissors to cut them, to cut them down. And I think it's really important to be mindful that we are all humans, and we're all struggle and go through things, and to just be, like, you don't always have to accept everything from everyone, but to be mindful of those things.
Yeah, and I feel like that kind of goes along with what I was saying earlier. Like, yeah, put your friends in check. My bad. Tell them when they're not doing the right thing.
Don't forget to turn your phone on silent.
Yeah, my bad.
When you're recording.
But don't judge them for it, you know? Okay. So then the last part is our recommendations. So obviously we recommend this book. We've been talking about it for half an hour already. But the reason why I love it is because it really does show you how to have healthy relationships with people, even though the relationships are not perfect. Like, the boys were mean to Hermione at first, but then they grow together and end up having a nice, healthy relationship that builds off of each other.
I'm going to take a different approach to why I love the book. Now, I'm going to go back to being 8 years old, reading this book for the first time, and loving this book because knowing what my childhood was like, knowing the struggle that I went through, being raised by a single dad, not really having anyone to depend on, even though he was great, he was always at work, and just, like, always being that kid nobody wanted because everybody had to babysit me. Mm-hmm. I think after reading this book, for me, it was like a home away from home. And I loved this book because it gave me the opportunity to, like, imagine the possibilities of what life could be like. And even though it was fantasy and it's not real, like, there was a part of it that was real. Friendship, love, adventure. Those things are real.
Yeah.
Those things can happen in real life, but you have to, like, take the initiative to make them happen. And so for me, it was just, like, one moment to actually be able to, like, go into this awesome world and, like, and be imaginative. And so for me, that's why I fell in love with these books in the first place, was I didn't love my reality, but I loved my fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's made it amazing. I mean, now I have a best friend who we just have wands together and we just go to Hogwarts and let's just go to Universal Studios. We have Harry Potter weekends and it's great. So, and it's a... And let's be real, we haven't read these books in years, but it's still something we can talk about all these years later.
Like that Maya Angelou quote about, it's about how people make you feel. It's also about how books make you feel. You might not remember every single word of it, but you're going to remember how it made you feel.
Exactly. So thanks, guys. Miss Chim out. Holler.
Bye, guys.